I'm Tom Slaw, the Executive Director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. TSIA interfaces with all types of technology companies that serve every industry imaginable. Today, we'll be talking to Angelica Ryman, the SVP and President of the CrossLab Group at Agilent. And if you're not familiar with Agilent Technologies, they are a global leader in lab instruments, software, consumables, and services that power the day-to-day work of modern laboratories, especially in life sciences, diagnostics, and applied chemical markets. What makes Agilent especially interesting is its hybrid business model. It sells high-value hardware platforms, but it also generates durable, recurring revenue through consumables and services, including Angelica's Agilent's CrossLab organization, which supports customers across the install base with maintenance, optimization, and lab productivity services. We're going to click in to how the trends impacting enterprise IT technology providers is also impacting a company like Agilent. So let's get the insight engine humming here. Angelica, welcome to Tectonic. It's nice to see you again. We haven't seen each other for a little while. And, you know, as I mentioned, we study tech business models, all kind of traditional enterprise software and hardware. And it was interesting when I was doing research for this, I did not realize that Agilent was one of the biggest IPOs in the history of Silicon Valley up to that point. In 1999, you were spun out from HP, and you obviously had this sort of specialized equipment and very traditional sort of hardware company. But now, I mean, you have SaaS, you have software, you talk a lot as a company about growing recurring revenue. So how does a traditional old school hardware company grow recurring revenue? Let's talk a little bit about how you guys are going about that.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas. It's great to spend time here with you today. So thanks for inviting me. You know, Agilent has a long history. When you go back that far, right, it was, I think, touted as the first $6 billion startup when it split off from HP. But Agilent has deep roots in instrumentation that dates all the way back to HP. And today, our growth, it really blends the strength of that installed base with a broad portfolio, as you said, of services, consumables, software, also automation. Mm-hmm. And Agilent CrossLab Group focuses on everything that keeps that lab productive throughout the life cycle, not just the first time that they purchase an instrument, but like all of the workflow needs that follow for years after that initial instrument purchase. So our scale is a significant advantage. We support one of the largest installed bases globally, not only Agilent instruments, but also third party instruments, and that allows us to deliver value throughout the entire life cycle of the lab. And when you combine that all together, things like workflow consumables, service capabilities, the support, the digital tools, it allows us to really have this virtuous cycle of recurring revenue that's built on the relationships and the support that we provide customers for the initial purchase, but then also many years to come.
And so what I heard there is you're actually supporting third-party products when you're supporting customers. So you've got your core products, but if there's third-party products they're using as well and they need help or services around that, you support that as well?
Yes, actually, many of our products are instrument agnostic. So if you think about, you know, some of our consumables, as well as some of the services that we offer, as well as software, we meet customers where they are. And while we would love for customers to be just purely an Agilent house, as we would say, we know that customers, you know, need to build redundancy into their lab operations. And so they do often have a mix of different vendors, equipment, and technologies in the laboratory. And our goal is to help make them successful. And if that means we start off helping them be successful in a mixed environment, we hope that it builds the loyalty, the trust, and the relationship that as they look to advancing their lab and bringing in new technology, that they're thinking Agilent first.
And I'm just intellectually curious about that labor market, because if you think about, you know, anybody who has, you know, specialized equipment like that, the decision of, well, do I hire people to maintain that, you know, who are my employees, or do I basically turn to an outside provider like yourselves? My gut is that it's harder and harder to find the skill set to basically hire those employees and do it themselves. So do you see that there's more demand for where they're knocking on your door saying, hey, can you help us here? Can you help us there? Because, you know, you guys can do this, as you said earlier, at scale.
Yeah, I think that is one of the benefits we have is our scale, as well as our reputation in the marketplace and the relationships that we've built over that long history, dating all the way back to HP time. And I think customers recognize, and we've demonstrated, how much we value our customers' success and their ability to do great science. So when they're looking to a partner that can help them keep that pace of innovation and keep the pace with their business, scientific, and economic outcomes that they're trying to drive in their enterprises, they're turning more and more often to a partner that they can trust in understanding what problems they're trying to solve and bringing the expertise and the capabilities, both with people delivering those services, but also some of the investments that we've been making in digitally enabled or digitally enhanced service capabilities.
Yep. Awesome. And I definitely want to talk about how delivery is changing in your world. But one thing I'm curious about is we talk to a lot of traditional enterprise hardware and software companies, and that buying process, right? If people are buying hardware or software for, you know, classic IT stuff, has changed. There's just a lot more scrutiny there. You know, the budgets, you know, everyone's like looking at every dollar about, you know, what they're going to spend. And I'm curious, in the world of life sciences, how has the buying process, the budgeting process changed in your world? Is it not changed? Is it the same? Is there more scrutiny? Tell me, you know, what you're experiencing there.
Yeah, today's labs are driven by a number of motivating factors, right? One of them, obviously, is the need to better manage and have visibility to budgets, both CapEx as well as OpEx. Yeah. But they're also motivated by accelerating their pace of innovation and driving greater productivity. So all of that together influences how customers buy, but it doesn't change their fundamental need or desire for high quality, reliable products and services that help them do that great science. So it's not a uniform customer behavior that we're seeing. And it makes it both interesting as well as challenging in being able to meet customers where we need to meet them.
Yeah. Again, it's super interesting to me. I think the way that we see executives making decisions around what is going to be that ROI? Like, you know, you use the term accelerate. How is this going to accelerate us? That they really want to understand that in ways that before be like, oh, hey, well, here's the latest technology and it's going to help us. I'm sure it's going to be great. I think the bar has gotten higher in other industries, and I'm sure you guys are facing that as well. And, you know, one of the things that we hear a lot from other members is just getting more anchored on outcomes. What is the outcome if I invest in this particular either product or service from Agilent? What is the outcome? What kind of conversations are you seeing there with customers?
Yeah, you know, I think being a member of TSIA, I've certainly had the benefits of learning from other members' journeys with respect to this. And I think our customers are taking us there for sure, but I think we're still a bit early on that curve. Customers do care about outcomes, and they're today really thinking about that in the context of things like productivity or their ability to deliver on the results to their internal or external customers with the right business profile, with the right scientific sort of insights. Because we do have some customers in those more compliant environments, being able to operate at pace while maintaining compliance. So those are definitely themes that we continue to hear from customers that we have evolved our portfolio to support. But in terms of really doing outcome-based pricing models, we're not quite there yet. I think we're approaching that, and we're well positioned to be able to support customers as they're ready to toggle to a business model that looks more like that. But there's still some underlying principles of the markets that we're working in that we're going to have to overcome together with our customers.
Yeah, I mean, again, and most companies do struggle to actually get across the goal line with truly an outcome-based priced offer, for sure, because there's a lot of complexity there. But I think customers are trying to just connect the dots better, right? Between, you know, I really want to be able to talk an outcome and just help the audience understand in your world, in your customers when it comes to outcomes, what are those kind of outcomes, right? Is it time to market on a product? Is it a cost per something, you know, to do something? You know, what are the outcomes that are driving their world?
Yeah. You mentioned all of the end markets that we serve in the intro. And I think if you look across the life sciences, the applied markets, and, you know, clinical and diagnostics, they touch on all of the themes you just mentioned in terms of, you know, life sciences, biopharma customers. They are wanting to get to that next discovery faster, right? Mm-hmm. That next therapy faster, and how to be able to ensure or predict, you know, it's going to get through the clinic and it's going to have the efficacy that it needs, and to be able to get it into patients' hands as quickly, responsibly, and as compliantly as possible. When you think about the applied markets, it's a little bit different. It is about getting a product to market. If you think about some of the contract testing laboratories that we support in the applied markets, the way that they gain new customers and they're able to grow wallet share of their customers, it's based on the types of applications that they can run for the mm-hmm. customer, the types of results that they can provide them. And so being able to develop, scale, and then commercialize those applications means that they're filling their customer funnel, right, with higher quality yeah. customers. And if you're looking at more of the clinical and diagnostics, that's where you're going to see customers looking a little bit more at cost per sample. You have some other market dynamics around reimbursements and things that are going to slightly change what's important to them. But those outcomes are becoming increasingly important, no matter which end market you're in.
Interesting. So how do you think there's outcome-based pricing is something, again, in the future that, you know, may or may not occur in different markets, but how do you see pricing changing just in 2026? Is there anything that's changing the way people, you know, are consuming from you or want things to be priced in this current environment?
Yeah, I would say it depends on the customer. And now I'm not necessarily talking about the end market specifically, but the customer buying personas. So, you know, we've got a breadth of customers around the world, and we've got customers of all different shapes and sizes. So we've experimented with a lot of different pricing models, and definitely it's not a one size fits all, because if you're talking about selling directly to a bench scientist mm-hmm. versus a lab manager or a head of procurement, sometimes even selling to the C-suite, each of those conversations is going to differ in terms of the assignment of value and outcomes. They're going to look and feel a little different, right? To someone who's a lab manager looking to upgrade their lab operations over maybe a phase tech refresh program, they're going to be looking for different value drivers and different outcomes than someone who's simply looking for, you know, hey, my OpEx spend is going to be flat over the next 3 years. So how can you help me better predict my OpEx spend across, let's say, multiple years of instrument usage, whether that's on the consumables or the services side? And, mm-hmm. and when you're talking in procurement, it's like pricing transparency, mm-hmm. right? I want more transparency to how you're pricing out this particular deal, because they're trying to look for those cost savings targets, because for them, right, outcomes are tied to their goals, and their goals are often tied to, right, saving the company money. Yeah. So it really does vary quite a lot, which makes it both exciting, but also, you know, a little complex in terms of how we approach pricing as a strategy.
So, okay. What is super interesting is you talk about the fact that there are all these different personas, and for each persona, the way you unfold pricing, it sounds like you are going to do that differently. You're going to have to put that conversation and the way you structure that conversation differently to stick the landing with that particular persona. Is that the way you basically, in a sense, manage the market?
It is. We have the benefits of a single commercial organization that, you know, basically is a horizontal across the whole of the Agilent portfolio. So it allows us to work very closely with our commercial team to ensure that, like, we're not only evolving our portfolio and our offers and our capabilities, but we're also able to package and price those capabilities in a way that meets customers where they are, and it really addresses the particular needs that are motivating their buying decision. And so we're able to flex and scale those capabilities in a pretty agile way. And over time, will we begin to see some pretty clear swim lanes of how we want to really standardize our approach to market? I think we will. But right now, we have a tremendous ability to be flexible and to support our customers in the way they want to buy and the way they need to be supported.
So I have to ask this question. So there's a simple and there's a complex, right? So a simple scenario for you might be, I'm working with a customer. We're working with procurement. We know their persona. This is how we unfold the pricing. It's pretty straightforward, right? Another customer might be the person more closer to lab who's working on their OPEX. We know how to, for some of your larger accounts, the complex scenario in my mind would be if you have multiple personas in play around the same deal, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're dealing with the ops person, you're dealing with procurement, but maybe you're also talking to the C-suite. Tell me how you navigate that, because again, they want to hear different things, but you need to rationalize the pricing in a meaningful way across all those buyers.
Yeah. And those are some of the most interesting opportunities for us. And we have, as I mentioned, that single commercial organization. We also have strategic customer account managers. So they're basically the single point of contact into some of these more complex types of customer types. And they help the whole organization work together behind the scenes to really navigate, understand the scope and scale of the opportunity, understand how do we flex our collective capabilities across the organization. And so we're not doing it all independently and tripping over each other and trying to figure out, right, where's the give and take? What are the compromises? We've got a really nice cohesive approach into those kinds of opportunities. And they give us a lot of learnings that we can then take away and leverage more broadly across other customer types. But one thing I might add here is that not every one of our customer engagements requires a human in the loop. In a recurring revenue business, you have an opportunity to also invest in digital buying experiences to support customers and in that more transactional nature. So we've actually invested quite a lot in not only our website capabilities, but also our e-commerce engine and generally our digital capabilities to help certain customers. And sometimes they're even in those strategic complex accounts where they simply just want to search, find, select, and buy, and they don't need to engage with anyone. And they have that really seamless, frictionless buying experience. And so we're really looking holistically at that ecosystem to make sure that we're optimizing it in a number of ways.
Let's click into that, because there's a couple things with that digital experience in buying. And if you think about, and I've talked about this with so many different, you know, enterprise tech companies, because you say, look, you know, there's consumer tech and there's enterprise tech. And consumer tech, long ago, for all of us, we are super happy to pick up our phone and click a button and order something. And we it's amazing how much money we will spend at the click of a button on a website or on our phone, right? And so we are very conditioned to that digital experience. And what you heard for years was, yeah, but that's never going to fly in enterprise. That's just, it's too complex. That's not the way people want to buy, et cetera, et cetera. But what you just articulated is that there's a lot you can sell digitally. And customers, you know, and I believe this deeply, they prefer that more frictionless approach. You know, don't make me call somebody and place this order if literally I can go to your website or, you know, and then you layer these new AI capabilities on top of your website to can really help a customer navigate. So they're like, oh, I don't know if I need part A or part B, or it's like, let me help you with that. So talk a little bit about what you guys are either doing there or your visions there about how far you think you can take that digital experience.
Yeah, I mean, we've made so much progress over, you know, the course of, let's call it, the last 10 years, we've been investing and refining and updating that digital customer experience. And we crossed a pretty significant milestone in terms of the number of dollars that we transact with customers online for some of the, I would say, less complex types of instruments, but also our recurring revenue businesses and consumables, services, and even software. And I think the investment is not just on the tech side of things, but the investment has to also be on the content. Because, you know, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't have content organized and relevant and personalized for customers, you can put it into a great platform, but it sort of goes there to die. And so the investment also has to be on the strategy, the operational focus, and then the execution on how are we actually making the content in that experience relevant and high impact for customers that are visiting the website. And then, obviously, yes, you can layer on a lot of technology to be able to further customize that experience for customers. It recognizes them. It remembers what they've done. It also looks at their history and it recommends the next best product that they might want to consider because customers, right, typical benchmarking, customers like you who've bought this have also bought it. So it allows you to upsell and cross-sell, but also make customers aware of things they may not have necessarily organically found or even thought that they needed to go find. Now, that's sort of like the selling motion, but there's a support motion that we've been supporting here as well. We know that customers, you know, in this need for greater efficiency and productivity and some of what we talked about before, customers don't necessarily want to wait for a field service engineer to come on site and do maybe what could be a basic repair they could actually do themselves. And so we've invested a lot into self-serve capabilities so that customers with a simple issue can go search and hopefully find something that they can resolve on their own. But it will also then direct them to a more technical resource within the company. If it goes beyond sort of that simple solution, they can talk with someone on the phone, they can schedule a service engineer to come on site and do that. So even evolving how digital and human services are also increasingly important to support our customers.
So as I listen to you and again, as I talk to others about where they feel some of these interfaces are going to go, I think going back to just ordering consumables, et cetera, ultimately, and I believe this, that is going to end up being an agent to agent conversation. That is going to be, you have an agent that their agent talks to and says, hey, I need this, I need that. And that stuff just gets taken care of, right? So people don't have to stay on top of that. But I'm curious, and when it comes to the service experience, et cetera, talk a little bit about your customers. Do you find them forward-leaning on, you know, leveraging technology, or are they more sort of old school, like, hey, why are you making me do this? I'm just curious. I mean, how receptive are they? Because every industry is different there. Every industry is different. And so I don't know life sciences and stuff as well. But so when you have these new capabilities, like, look, you don't have to call that field. You can just literally do this here. Or you can just click this button or that. How are, you know, is that a lot of education or do you find that they're super receptive? What's your experience there?
You know, it's going to vary, right? I think that, you know, we do see some pretty strong adoption of things like our self-serve capabilities, you know, troubleshoot whatever issue that you're having, easy to find solutions. So we've seen a pretty good ramp up of adoption. And I would say adoption is a two-way thing, right? You've sort of anchored in on customer adoption, but also the internal adoption.
Sure.
Right. And, you know, I think as our installed base continues to grow and as turnover continues to happen in these laboratories, our folks on the front line, they're seeing more and more engagements with customers. And so being able to teach customers, you know, next time you don't have to call in, you could go here first. You know, there's, I think, a good adoption of our own internal folks training our customers that there are other options for them to get to solutions more quickly, but also they're adopting some internal tools. As you can imagine, with so many decades of history. We have a lot of documentation, a lot of know-how, a lot of different tools that we have sort of accumulated over time, and a lot of knowledge in here, right, up in people's minds. It's sometimes hard when you've got somebody on a phone call to be able to very quickly navigate maybe 20 tools, right, to find the answer. You sort of know where you think it was, but you can't necessarily get your fingers on it. So we invested in an AI tool that allows us to basically curate rapidly all that vast information across all of these different resources. And now it's the only way that our internal service folks work. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't want to go back to the old way of doing things. Yeah. It's so much easier to do a natural language search, right? And then get presented the information that they need, not the stuff they have to filter through. And so we're seeing great adoption on the internal tools that we're enabling with AI and technology, but we're also seeing our customers adopt it too. Now, you know, does every customer adopt at the same pace? No, of course not. But I think as you're seeing the generational turnover that's just naturally happening in every industry, I think you're going to see these digital native talents come in, and they're not going to be patient. They're going to want and expect a much more digital first experience. And I think we've got the tools, we've made the investment, and we're ready to serve them as they come up the ranks and they come into the laboratory setting.
Yeah, I mean, the environment that you're describing there, right? You guys have a lot of products in the portfolio. There's a lot of complexity there. These are very precise instruments in these environments and these workflows. And so when you're servicing that, that is, it's always been a challenge, right? And that is where I think, AI tools like you're describing are complete game changers for the ability to service, make your people, more effective, get to the right answers quicker, mm-hmm. All that kind of fun stuff. And it's interesting, you said you're seeing that, uptick in internal adoption. As I bring back the lens of the industry, it is amazing to me because these tools are so powerful. If you deploy them and you're, like you said, you're bringing all this information from all these different sources right at their fingertips, super powerful. There still is this lag where people are just like, well, that's not the way I've always done it. It's like, I'm used to, doing it this whole way. But I think once people get on the train and they use those types of tools, like you're saying, they're like, don't make me go back. Do not make me go back to the old way, because it is just amazing, the efforts that's being saved there. So I want to talk a little bit about CrossLabs as sort of an economic engine for Agilent. Because again, if you look at hardware companies historically, I ship boxes. This is what I do. I'm really good at this. This is how I make my money. I know how to do this. I know how to scale this. And this service thing, whatever it is, right? Besides, I like the consumables, but anything else is just, it's kind of messy. It's not really what I do. And so it's usually a very, very small percentage of revenue, typically just focused on the very most important customers. But when I read your financial documents, et cetera, CrossLabs is really being positioned as a growth engine for the company, beautiful recurring revenue. So talk a little bit about the vision there that Agilent has for, the potential of services within the business model.
Yeah. It is and it has been a growth engine for Agilent over the years. And it really started probably about 15, 20 years ago, where, there were some really great leaders who sort of, made the early decision that services isn't just a cost of doing business in supporting customers with highly sophisticated analytical instruments that are doing great science. They said, this is a potential value creation opportunity for us. And so we've been on that journey to really scale services to be that value driver for our customers. But then when you deliver the right value to customers, you get the benefits then of customers voting with their dollars and being able to build that trusted relationship. And when you look at the way that Agilent CrossLab Group has come together in terms of the various portfolios and offers, right? We're one group, and our whole purpose is to help customers do great science and be more productive in their laboratories. Mm-hmm. It's bringing together consumables, services, automation, software in a way that it creates a flywheel for Agilent's growth, but also a flywheel for customers and their productivity. Because It all starts with this opportunity to sell a new instrument platform. We've made a really deliberate shift towards selling total workflow solutions as opposed to just selling the box. So we've been evolving our thinking beyond that box mentality that you mentioned earlier. The result we're seeing is that it A, really resonates with our customers, because customers aren't buying a box to just be a box on the bench. They need it to deliver a result for them. So this idea of selling the total workflow solution and really the wrapper of how do you make the box, right, generate the outcome you're looking for, we're seeing higher attachment rates of consumable software and services. And it allows us from the very beginning to start building that relationship, that trusted partner relationship with customers, which then means, right, there's a stickiness that's built out of that relationship. And the way that those capabilities are allowing customers to do the work that they need to do and not worry about the things that they really ought not worry about, we can worry about it for them. So it allows us to really support customers in a way that continues to help us identify new opportunities that are contributing to our customers, but also Agilent's growth.
Yeah. I mean, what you're describing, that flywheel, I mean, I personally believe very deeply in, focused on the world of, you know, technology services and the role of services supporting product companies. But it is interesting. I feel I'm very bullish about the future of services around any tech, because I think that, you know, because people talk about how, well, AI is going to just get, you don't need support, you don't need customer success, you don't need professional services. I'm seeing quite the opposite unfold here. I think that as the technology is becoming even more and more powerful for things that you can unlock for your customers, it is the complete thought that matters. And that complete thought is, we have this combination of technologies plus these service capabilities, whether they're, you know, people, digital capabilities that we can put together to get you to the value, whether you're priced around that or not. And I think that there's more executive teams that light bulb is going off, that they're realizing that it has to be the complete thought if we really want the market share, if we really want the revenue, if we really want the margin. And so I think it's an exciting time for services, whether it's Cross Labs or anywhere else. I think this is a really great time to be in this part of the business in tech. So we'll see how it unfolds the next couple of years. But I'm excited. I don't know about you, but I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited too. You know, I think the technology is really, it's so complementary, and it can be needle moving in terms of the ability to expand scale and reach and be able to support customers in ways that we, in today's world, haven't yet imagined. And that's super exciting.
It is. Well, I'm watching the clock here. I appreciate you coming in and talking a little bit about the world of life sciences. Again, it's a different world, different kind of buyer, but a lot of the same challenges, whether it's enterprise tech or life sciences tech. But it was great getting your perspective on that world. So I appreciate you coming in. And I always end with a question of the day. And my question for the audience here is, regardless of what industry you are serving, how will you sell your technology products in a rapidly changing world? And does your company have the capabilities to succeed in this new environment? Cheers, everybody.